This is an AMI podcast.
Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV. Good morning. It's Wednesday, March the 29th, 2023. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go. Coming up on the show today, there's a new book that puts the tale of King Arthur into modern-day Vancouver with some very positive representation. Author Jess Battis describes their new book, The Winter Night. Plus, with Shake Shack food brands and their presence in today, but with a top story about the federal budget. The federal budget has been presented in the House of Commons. There is billions of dollars in new spending on healthcare and green technology. The government is projecting a $40 billion deficit in the next fiscal year. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland says the spending is part of a long-term plan.
We're ensuring that we can continue to invest in Canadians and in the Canadian economy for years to come, just as we have done since 2015. Because we know that investments in Canadians are also investments in our economy.
Freeland discussed the significance of investing in the green economy.
The race to build the clean economies of the 21st century and our allies accelerating efforts to friendshore their economies.
11 million Canadians will receive an increased GST rebate to deal with the rising cost of living. The government is also expanding its dental care program. Laura Osmond explains the changes.
This program is the linchpin of the Liberals' confidence and supply deal with the NDP to prevent an election before 2025. Last year, the government set up a temporary benefit for uninsured middle-income children under the age of 12. That benefit will be scrapped and replaced by a government-administered insurance program for anyone without dental insurance at that household income level. The cost has grown to $13 billion over 5 years, beginning in the fiscal year 2023-2024. The government plans to launch the insurance plan by the end of the year for eligible people under 18, seniors, and people with disabilities. Laura Osmond, The Canadian Press, Ottawa.
Going a little bit further into the dental plan, Minister Freeland discusses the rationale behind expanding dental coverage.
This will mean that no Canadian ever again will need to choose between taking care of their teeth and paying the bills at the end of the month. It will mean you can't tell the size of someone's paycheck by their smile.
Freeland is asking government departments to cut their internal spending by 3%. Freeland thinks this is an achievable goal.
Those savings will come from government operations. And I think that those savings are imminently attainable.
The government will also spend less money on travel and consultants. Here's what Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre had to say about the budget.
All that they have delivered is more debt, more inflation, and more costs on the backs of the hardworking and beleaguered people of this country. And that is why Conservatives are proud to announce we will be voting against this inflationary spend.
So that's the story around the Canadian federal budget. South of the border, they're going through their own budget battle. I want to play a story that shares some opinion polling about government spending in the United States. Here's Jennifer King.
As President Biden and House Republicans continue their budget standoff, 60% of U.S. adults say the government spends too much money. That's up sharply from only 25% in May of 2020 after the pandemic forced major disruptions. But the mid-March poll by the Associated Press and the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research also found majorities favor more spending for programs they consider the most important, like infrastructure, health care, and Social Security. It shows how the public is asking lawmakers to pull off the impossible, cut the overall size of the government, but devote more money to popular and expensive programs. Jennifer King, Washington.
So why did I play that story for you this morning? Because you may be up in arms today about the $40 billion of deficit the government is adding to the overall debt to the Canadian federal government. Understandably so. I've had a lot of conversations on this show about debt and how dangerous it can be to accumulate and accrue debt over and over and over again. But the crux in that story is when you do start screaming about fiscal responsibility, the reasonable follow-up question that you should expect to hear is, where are you finding that money? Where do you want to make those cuts? Do you want them on big ticket items like the military and healthcare? And your answer is probably going to be no. Do you want less supports for people with disabilities? The answer is probably going to be no. Do you want less supports for seniors? The answer is probably going to be no. So just know, when you scream today about a $40 billion deficit, be ready to answer that question. I know where I would try and save some money. I'd be offering way less handouts to corporations. I'd be offering way less tax credits to corporations, particularly extremely profitable ones like the energy sector. That's maybe where I would save a little bit of money. I would also take a closer look at what kind of arts funding the government offers. When major music festivals like Ottawa Blues Fest, that brings in acts like the Foo Fighters and Mumford & Sons, gets some sweetheart deals on government lands and even gets a little bit of federal government money to put the festival on, but still charges $80 for a ticket, I would tell you maybe we can save a dollar or two there. So that's where I'd make my argument this morning. What argument do you want to make? Let's get to a few more financial stories to share with you. Members of the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Treasury Department, and Federal Reserve have testified before the Senate Banking Committee to discuss recent bank collapses. ABC's Alexis Christophorus reports Congress will likely be looking to tighten regulations.
Really, in essence, regulation hasn't kept up with the times. Social media can spread news now instantaneously. We can withdraw and deposit funds from a bank online in moments. So it seems as though the regulation has sort of not kept up with the technology.
The hearing was the first formal congressional inquiry into recent bank failures. Speaking of a different kind of failure, FTX crypto exchange founder Sam Bankman-Fried is facing new charges. Julie Walker has that story.
The rewritten indictment against the 31-year-old adds a charge of conspiracy to violate the anti-bribery provisions of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's the 13th charge facing Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF as he's being called, as he awaits trial in New York while out on bail staying with his parents in California. He's already pleaded not guilty to charges he cheated investors out of billions of dollars before his business collapsed last year. Now the feds say he paid the $40 million to Chinese officials to unfreeze assets relating to his cryptocurrency business in that country. I'm Julie Walker.
So just a point about crypto. Mass media spent most of late 2022 burying cryptocurrency amidst some price collapses, particularly of garbage coins that were created simply to ride the wave of speculation. But let's talk about Bitcoin, the Coca-Cola of cryptocurrency. As of this morning, Bitcoin is trading at over $38,000 per coin. That's up nearly $12,000 in the last 6 months. That's a big bounce, right? But zoom out a little bit. In the last 12 months, it's still down nearly $21,000 per coin. Crypto is volatile. It always has been. But seeing as how I shared a crypto exchange story, I did want to offer a little bit more context. A little more context is needed. That's what I should rename this show. A little more context with Dave Brown. And that thought leads into the daily polls. At Accessible Media is where you vote on Twitter. At Accessible Media Inc. is where you vote on Facebook. On Tuesday, we asked you, do you support for-profit zoos, aquariums, etc.? 15% of you said yes. 85% of you said no. Today's daily poll, having to deal a bit with the economy and my last thought on cryptocurrency, at Accessible Media on Twitter, at Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook, how have current economic conditions impacted your view on cryptocurrency? A lot, a little, or not at all? I'll tell you, mine lands at not at all. I'm not a crypto evangelical, nor am I someone who dismisses it completely offhand. I just think speculation has got in the way of what is at least a somewhat reasonable use case, but volatility has made that use case very difficult to manifest for different places. So mine has not shifted at all, But I did share some of those numbers for you in the midst of the FTX collapse and some of the holdings collapses, some of the price bouncing, and of course, interest rates and bank failures. I am genuinely curious to know if these current economic conditions have impacted your views at all on cryptocurrency. So a little, a lot, or not at all. Alex Smyth, what do you think?
Yeah, Dave, I don't think for me it's really impacted it at all. I've always been very skeptical of cryptocurrencies. I've always seen it as hugely volatile, high risk, low chance for, you know, growth, wealth, opportunity, and people who are far more into the weeds and far more up to date are going to be the ones who are going to make the money. And the average person is usually going to be left holding the bag. That's typically how it is with these types of investments and these types of risk filled investments. And so that's how I've always viewed it. And so it doesn't surprise me that you have these collapses of these cryptocurrency institutions and that there's like, oh, well, now regulations are coming in, because that was always what crypto really kind of built its mark on. It's like, look, this is far more protected. It's a bit more invisible in how transactions are happening, especially when you combine that with blockchain technology. This was something that was completely digital that I do not fully trust, because there were so many ways that it could go wrong. When you don't tie true investments into something tangible, that's where that volatility comes from, and it has a huge risk to being exploited. It's been exploited, but now you're starting to see, okay, the bill comes due. Okay, we're shutting down FTX. Okay, we're investigating it for fraud, for mishandling of funds, things like that. So it's going to continue. I'm sure that as they continue to pull back and look at all these other cryptocurrencies, yeah, Bitcoin has been able to hold on relatively well.
But that's the point, Alex, right? Like, when we're talking about FTX, that is an exchange that failed. And by the way, two banks have failed in the U.S. in the last month, and one almost failed in Switzerland. So, like, there is some instability across all these sectors. It's not fair to point to one without pointing to the other. Now, Silicon Valley Bank may not have been massive fraud like FTX or alleged fraud like FTX, but like, we're still talking about instability, and regulators rushed to save these banks and save these assets, whereas that is not the case in the case of crypto, because there are no backbones or defenses or protections for crypto investing. That's part of the point. But what I would say here, Alex, is I'm not someone who invests in crypto. I see the use case, but as I mentioned, the use case does not equate to the dollars and cents right now. And the fact is, a lot of people who got burned on crypto bought a lot of garbage coins. They bought a lot of stuff that was created literally out of thin air. When I refer to Bitcoin as the Coca-Cola of cryptocurrency, I mean that. That is the gold standard within cryptocurrency. It's not some coin that was imagined out of thin air on a Saturday night, given a funny name. Like, this is a real asset that is worth $38,000 per. And yes, it's still down $21,000 year over year, but people were burying cryptocurrency and burying Bitcoin a couple of months ago based on their own biases. So that's one of the reasons why this morning I sit here and I say my opinion is not moved at all, but because I have an entrenched moderate position on cryptocurrency, particularly at the top end of cryptocurrency. I'm very well aware of what junk is and what junk coins are below that. And again, I don't hold it. I would never advise somebody to hold it, but I would simply say the way that people dismiss it outright is saying it's the Wild West out here. I would point to banking systems in North America, particularly in the US, that are now desperately needing regulations because of their own lacking regulations.
Yeah, but you could also argue too that there are some forms of regulations when it comes to those banking systems. They may be outdated. They may need to be enforced on a different level and reevaluated. But there's much more regulations on the American banking system than there is in the crypto space. And that's really what we're seeing with the example of FTX. I agree with you, though. It hasn't protected other banks from collapsing, and the American government and other foreign governments are much more likely to jump to the fence and to the aid of established banks than through the crypto space. So there is this challenge. It's the old way of thinking versus a new way of thinking. Given time, will perceptions change and views change on Bitcoin? Maybe, but I still see there is a long way to go. There needs to be just a record of success and stability, I think, for more people to get on board. Because, yeah, it's trading at a thousands of dollars per coin. But as you mentioned, it's like the volatility of it, it's been so high, it's been so low. And, you know, you can't really grasp onto that and feel there's some sort of baseline to it, because it really hasn't been in the last 5-10 years.
The other issue is that people purely envision crypto as an investment vehicle rather than a currency. Bitcoin is not a company. Bitcoin is a currency. It used to be the Thai baht. Right. In the late 1990s, the Thai baht was pegged to the U.S. dollar. And due to some speculation in the trading industry, that currency collapsed and therefore the Thai economy collapsed. Right. So again, currency, investing in currency is not the same thing as investing in a company. And people forget that. They think buying Bitcoin means I am an owner in Bitcoin, the company. No, you own some currency. The same thing as owning a Canadian dollar or U.S. dollar that just isn't backed by a central bank. Alex, we've officially wandered too far into the weeds and need to move on. But you should vote on the daily poll at Accessible Media on Twitter, at Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. How have current economic conditions impacted your view on cryptocurrency? A lot, a little, or not at all? Let's go back to Alex for the national weather updates.
Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. Starting off in St. John's, Newfoundland, there's snow off and on today. The high is 0 degrees, but it's going to be feeling like -7 with that wind chill. In Halifax, Nova Scotia, it's a mix of sun and clouds with a chance of rain this afternoon. The high is +7, but feeling like -7 this morning with the wind chill. In Montreal, Quebec, it is sunny with clouds moving in along with a chance of rain in the afternoon. The high is also 7 degrees, but there is a wind chill that makes that feel more like -9. Over to Ottawa, Ontario, it's cloudy with heavy rain or snow starting this afternoon. There's also wind gusts up to 50 kilometers per hour. The high in Ottawa is also 7 degrees, but there is a wind chill that makes it feel more like -10. Here in Toronto, Ontario, it's a mix of sun and clouds with heavy rain or snow expected this afternoon. We're not out of the weed just yet. Also, wind gusts up to 60 kilometers per hour, but the high is 8 degrees today. In Thunder Bay, Ontario, it's a mix of sun and clouds with a chance of rain this morning. The high is -3, the wind chill -20. To Winnipeg, Manitoba, it's mainly sunny today. The high is -5, the wind chill makes it feel, however, more like -29. The sunny conditions continue as we make our way over to Saskatoon, where it's a mix of sun and clouds and clearing up this afternoon. The high is -1, but cold again with that wind chill of -25. In Calgary, Alberta, it is mainly sunny today. The high is +6, but the wind chill makes it feel like -13. In Edmonton, Alberta, it's mainly sunny as well, though clouds are rolling in the afternoon. The high is +6 and feeling like -8. In Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, it's mainly cloudy with a chance of snow this morning. The high, -6. The wind chill, -20. But as we make our way into BC, it is beautiful conditions. So it's in Vancouver, BC. It's another gorgeous day. It's mainly sunny and a high of 13 degrees. And finally, in Victoria, BC, it's sunny, becoming a mix of sun and clouds today in the afternoon. But the high is also 13 degrees. And that's our AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Alex. Coming up after the break, there's a new book that takes the Arthurian tale and the Knights of the Round Table and puts them into Vancouver. Author Jess Battis describes their upcoming book, The Winter Nights. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. There's a new book that puts a modern spin on a classic story. The Winter Knight places the Arthurian tale and the Knights of the Round Table into Vancouver. Diverse characters make up the backbone of the story with representation at its core. Jess Battis is the author of The Winter Knight, and Jess is here to talk about the book and what went into writing it. Hey, good morning, Jess. Thank you for making the time.
Morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So this is not your first book, but why were you inspired to put fingertip to keyboard on the winter nights?
It's a good question. I tend to write the type of urban fantasy that kind of explores what happens when you take something very old, like a myth, and you put it in a very new context, like a contemporary city. And I also teach Arthurian literature. My students are always interested in the kind of dramas between knights and wizards and characters like that, and all those entangled mythologies. And most of their understanding of that world comes from adaptations as opposed to the sort of original medieval sources. So I was really inspired by conversations that I had with them. And also, we're kind of seeing a renaissance of Arthurian literature, particularly in the young adult genre. I was really inspired by books like Once and Future by Amy Cappetta and Corey McCarthy, which is basically King Arthur in space, imagining the character of Arthur as a Muslim girl in a kind of a Firefly-esque space opera. So I was adapting a lot of the kind of interesting Arthurian versions that we were looking at in class. And I also wanted to center disabled and neurodivergent characters in The Winter Night, because we also see those experiences in the medieval sources as well, where those mythologies are taking shape.
I'm glad you mentioned inclusion and representation, because inclusion is something that we've been believing deeply on the show and on the network. Inclusion is written right on the walls throughout the office. How did you approach inclusion and representation in The Winter Nights?
I feel like this question is so big that we could spend the entire interview talking about it. The reality is, I wanted to write an epic story that centered trans and disabled and neurodivergent characters, because that's my world. Those are my people, my friends, and my family. And I do feel like we are under attack. There are over 300 anti-trans bills on the table in the US alone. And there's been a similar response, really, to disabled communities during the pandemic. Over 3 years, government's only solution for disabled people basically has been like, have you tried dying? There hasn't really been any tangible support. And my sense is that these trans and disabled genocides really are intertwined. They're all part of the same root. So I wanted to craft a story where disabled and trans people were the heroes, and not in a kind of every disabled person is heroic way, but to show that we can actually save the world. I think we're just starting to see more neurodivergent characters in science fiction, but I'd never really seen an autistic lead character in a fantasy novel before. And I wanted to challenge a lot of those pop culture narratives, specifically that see autistic characters as either like brilliant sociopaths or difficult burdens to their family. A character like Wayne is awkward and he has meltdowns, but he knows who he is and he succeeds because he thinks differently. And by the same token, it was really important for me to craft a character like Kai, who is strong and self-possessed as a trans woman, because often trans characters get frozen within a narrative of transition, because that's what cis readers are very interested in reading. And even though she has to deal with, you know, all the regular forms of trans misogyny that come from moving through the world, she knows who she is. And the real joy, I think, of digging back into those older sources was seeing that these people actually exist in the medieval literature, because we've existed in every era.
I know that the answer to this question may be a little bit self-evident, but as you said, we could probably spend all day talking about representation, and I'm kind of curious about doing that a little bit. Where does authenticity fit into that? I think you touched on it a little bit right there in terms of creating characters that are a little bit more than one note, but where does authenticity really matter in the way these stories are told and marginalized people are represented?
Well, I think, you know, historically in genres like fantasy and science fiction, we tend to see disabled characters in particular as people that are moving the plot forward in some way, or our disabilities are crafted in a way where we're trying to, you know, teach the able-bodied characters a lesson. And I think it's really only been in the last several decades that we're starting to see more disabled writers moving into genre fiction and actually crafting stories that center disabled characters that are coming from their own authentic experience. And this is not to say that, you know, one disabled perspective is going to be more authentic than another, but I think it's really crucial that we see the publishing world in particular opening up more to disabled writers. And that means that that world has to change in the sense that it is the sort of the work that you have to put into in order to maintain a career as an author is almost totally antithetical to the experiences of most disabled people. And that is one of the reasons why I think we're only just now starting to see more of those voices. And a lot of that has to do with the publishing world needing to change and it needing to be less driven by capitalism.
I've got a little bit of a literature question in conjunction with a writing question. Uh-oh. Here. Okay. When you're talking about this classic story, blending the Arthurian tale into a modern twist, you said you had some source material to pull from, but what you've created is unique. How did you go about creating that merger?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I've always really liked mashups in my writing. My first series was really kind of Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets CSI Las Vegas. I like that kind of that experiment of what happens if you take something very old and put it in a very new context. My main source was really this epic medieval poem called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. This was recently adapted into a successful film with the actor Dev Patel. And I remember just thinking, you know, what would Gawain do in a big city? How would the sort of challenges and temptations in a source like that, what would those look like in an urban context? And as the story became more of a murder mystery, I realized, well, okay, all these knights are killing each other. Someone has to be monitoring all of this like mythic crime, and it wouldn't be the knights themselves. And that was how I decided there would be this office of Valkyries, because Valkyries are also mythic beings, but, you know, originally they chose who lived and who died on the battlefield. So a lot of the character types that went into the story are really people that came from these old stories, like smart queens and anxious wizards and arrogant kings. The character of Kai was based on the knight Sir Kay, who's known for being impulsive. That's why her character became so confident. And I think taking these myths out of context, we get to see which parts are still relevant. And the book also talks a bit about how myths were tools of colonization, European myths in particular. The fact that English students know more about King Arthur than they do about local indigenous literatures is a case in point. Mm. And setting the story in Vancouver, which is unceded Coast Salish territory, these characters also have to reckon with the fact that their myths are upholding colonial values.
Jess, I have great admiration for writers. I consider myself to be a good writer for broadcast, but the beauty of that is after the broadcast, it vanishes into thin air, never to be seen again. You take on the much more difficult task of writing novels. What's your favorite part about writing? What brings you back over and over?
Well, this is maybe a selfish answer, but writing tends to calm my brain, I think. It's a bit like an apothecary where you combine histories and lives and experiences. But writing can also be really relational and create community. I've been thinking a lot lately about the OG Cree writer Joshua Whitehead, who talks about the fact that they are not the sole author of their stories, that their stories are part of a wider community, and stories need to be treated as siblings and ancestors, and which is the opposite of the capitalist publishing world. And I think that's more in line with the experience of disabled writers as well, because we're often writing to be in community with each other. I love creating worlds where people like me can thrive, and hopefully other people can find community in those worlds as well.
The flip side, one of the reasons why I have so much admiration for writers is I know how difficult it can be, especially when that Word document is big and blank. What's the hardest part about writing?
For me, I think the hardest part is feeling like it's not enough, that it's not radical enough. You know, that I should be hurling my body at bad people and sheltering all of my vulnerable friends in my spare bedroom, you know, like that sort of feeling. We're currently surrounded by ableism and transphobia and Christian fascism, and we know where it's leading. Storytelling is radical, but often it doesn't feel like enough. But I've been rereading work by the disabled writer Eli Clare. And in his book, Brilliant Imperfection, he talks about how we have to stop discarding what's broken in us, which is what society tells us to do. We have to claim it instead. And I think the limits of writing often bring me up against the limits of my own body and mind. Mm. But as I've adjusted over the years to writing more slowly and being a bit less productive, I find myself, you know, constantly being reintroduced to what's broken in me and claiming it. And that's a scary part of writing, but I think it's also a good part.
Oh, if you can give me any kind of advice on not sweating deadlines as much, I would definitely appreciate it. Jess, The Winter Night comes out April the 4th. Where can the audience go to learn more or maybe even buy a copy, pre-order a copy?
So the publisher, ECW Press, which is based out of Ontario, they've collected some lovely reviews for the book on their website. And if you go to sites like bookshop.org or IndieBound, you can buy copies and support your own local bookstore. I will say Penguin has also released an audiobook at the same time, which is coming out at the same time. And that includes queer and disabled voice actors. And you can pick that up. You can download that on their website. I'll also be doing a live stream event for the Old Firehouse Bookshop in Fort Collins on May 3rd. That'll be live streamed to their Facebook page. So you can check that out for more conversation about the book.
Jess, I say this to every author I interview. Congratulations on finishing the book. It's no small task. Can't wait to catch up with you again down the road and find out what you're working on next.
Thanks so much, Dave. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you.
That's Jess Battis, the author of The Winter Night. The Winter Night comes out on April 4th. Coming up after the break, Clover Thursday joins the show to talk a little bit about the inspiration that can be offered by plants and flowers and nature's, the beauty of the spring season. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. The signs of spring are all around you. The days, they're getting longer. The temperatures, they're rising. In some places faster than others. And flowers and blossoms are beginning to grow and sprout. Oh my goodness, it is cherry blossom season in Vancouver, one of my personal favorites, but here I am just freezing my tuchus off in Toronto. That has Clover Thursday feeling inspired. Hey, good morning, Clover.
Good morning.
Clover, I just spent the last segment talking to a creative person and I got to engage with you as another creative person in this segment. Winter can be a really difficult time to seek out inspiration. How did flowers and plants keep you inspired the last few months?
Oh, that's such a great question. Such an important question. I found personally what made flowers just such a wonderful thing to have in my, like, just my home. And my home is also my creative workspace as it be. It was that pop of color in a time where things get a little drab, a little, you know, monotone, a little dark. I think just having something that's just so bright and colorful and just naturally intricate is just a naturally inspiring thing. And just the fact of having something that was alive and living and something I was taking care of, that was like really like, you know, really set a good energy in my workplace. Sometimes you forget to like open the blinds, you know, and maybe, you know, get a little bit of sun, a little bit of vitamin D, get that going. But, you know, when you have a plant that's like, I need that to live, it kind of helps you, you know, it helps you kind of take care of yourself.
I 100% get that. I don't keep any plants in my apartment because I can't trust myself to care for them. But I also keep, because of my light sensitivity, I keep the blinds drawn a lot. That would inspire mm-hmm. me a little bit to get those blinds open, get a little more vitamin D in the room, and give my plant the love that it needs. Clover, where did this fascination and inspiration from plants and flowers come from? Is this new or is this a longstanding?
You know, honestly, I was thinking about that, and it's been a bit of a long-standing love. Like even in my own illustration practice, when I want like to kind of put something a bit more visually interesting, or I kind of just gravitate to the idea of plants and like flowers, you know, kind of incorporating them around characters, or even when I'm doing backgrounds, like my favorite backgrounds to do is like natural settings and like, you know, flowers and plants and leaves and all those things. So I've always kind of had really enjoyed the aesthetic of plants and like and greenery. So it's been a long time, and it just kind of comes and goes.
What's your take on receiving flowers as a gift?
I love receiving flowers as a gift. I have a joy of having a florist in my life. So sometimes I just will get, you know, just like these arrangements, and I think they're just so thoughtful, and I think they're kind of quite lasting. You know, you might not have, might not be, you know, making your own flower arrangements. I recommend it. But I think it's always just a really nice thing to have. And
Clover, I was being, you know, a little bit dry about my personal care of plants and flowers a few moments ago, but I want to tell you a quick story that during the pandemic, when the offices at AMI got shut down, there were only a few of us who were allowed to come in, and I was one of them. And our colleague, Dawn Dickinson, who takes care of a couple of our audio reading programs, had this plant that she'd had in the office for years and years and years. Like, we're talking maybe over a decade, Walter has been in this office. And she put it on me and said, Dave, you are now the carer of Walter until more people can get back into the office. Clover, I took this responsibility very seriously, and I'm here to say Walter is still alive and kicking today, although now in my old boss, Andy Frank's office. Andy's taken over custody of Walter.
Oh, that's so good. I'm so happy for Walter.
I felt a lot of pressure, but it was nice to keep Walter around and kicking. So Clover, that's the small scale of our experience with flowers or gardens. But we know that public gardens and greenhouses can also be a really great community area of engagement. Now, it's still early in the season for full blooms, but what are some places that jump out to you that you'd recommend that people keep their eyes and noses open for?
Oh, and that's actually funny when you say that, like, greenhouses come to mind. And that's what I love about greenhouses a lot of time. It could be the deepest, darkest of January, and these greenhouses are still, you know, open and you know, offering just like this this experience that is really hard and rare to have in Canada when it seems like we are snowed in and it's cold for like 6 months of the year. But a few of those places that pop into mind is Allen Gardens is a place that when I was living and working in Toronto and going to school there, that was a really wonderful place that I would go to, and we'd have, you know, our some drawing sessions there, and like a lot of those drawing clubs actually kind of came out of Allen Gardens, and they have turtles. So it's it's like, you know, at first when you're like, oh, there's a turtle pond. It's like, okay, there's going to be a couple of them. Allen Gardens is like dizzy with turtles. It's awesome. So I love that. That's in Toronto for folks who might not know. Here in Hamilton on the other side, we have Gage Park. And Gage Park has a really wonderfully taken care of greenhouse here. They have a lot of different sort of events happening. They had the type of bulb show just like a couple weeks back. And they're always promoting people to come there and use their space. And a lot of artists actually do come and congregate there as well. When the weather gets a little bit warmer, I would also recommend the Royal Botanical Gardens, kind of in the middle of all that in Burlington. They have just an amazing, expansive outdoor space with all the different different areas. You know, they have a couple like wetlands and things that you can walk around and, you know, go picnicking and just kind of settle in, and lots of really interesting and informative exhibits from arts to sciences, natural sciences in their indoor spaces as well. So those are some really wonderful places that jump to mind.
Yeah, sometimes it's natural and sometimes it's artificial, right? Sometimes it's a man-made celebration of flowers, and sometimes it's literally just a park that is having its own foliage grow and having its own plantation grow during the course of a summer. I mentioned that it is cherry blossom season in Vancouver. Yes, there is a park that specifically has cherry blossoms, but everywhere you go in the city, you can smell cherry blossoms. I know that in a couple months, it's going to be Ottawa Tulip Fest, which was one of my favorite things in Ottawa, even just like once or twice to wander around, right? Like wander around these amazing tulip fields that get donated to Ottawa in commemorance of World War II. What are some upcoming flower celebrations that you have marked on your calendar?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the cherry blossoms, because that is also something I love to look at a lot as well. I know High Park is kind of the place to go check out the cherry blossoms that kind of bloom around here. And that's usually, I have that kind of around for, you know, end of April, beginning of May, you know, weather permitting, mercifully, hopefully. but there's definitely, if you find High Park a little busy, there's absolutely, I know there's like full like horticultural like Reddits and groups that you can even like join to, you know, people take flower, I know flower watching really, flower viewing really seriously. So there's definitely people out there who are scoping out these areas where you can, you know, find these hidden gems and check out the cherry blossoms without running into so many people.
which is that's how you know you're appealing to my social agenda. Fun things with less people. Now we're really getting somewhere. Clover, in regards to gardening as a creative exercise, because you are an artist, right? That's one of the things that we talk about with you forever and ever and ever, your love of art. How is gardening an extension of the creative process?
It is amazing how much gardening and flower arrangement and whatnot is a creative practice and an artistic practice in its own right. And that, you know, it doesn't matter the size of your canvas. You can have a big sprawling, you know, backyard, or you can have, like me, who lives in an apartment with like no green space, you know, have your potted gardens like on your windowsill, or even just having that really lovely vase or like setting piece on your table. And I found that like it really is a creative practice, even just talking to, you know, a florist, and her approach to things was so similar to how I would approach art. And it's that idea of doing something very focused and very visual. And it doesn't even have to be visual as well. It's very tactile. So people even with sight loss can really benefit just like with the creative process of, you know, the moss and the dirt and, you know, the pebbles and, you know, the aromas and all the different sensations of like creating something and creating something that's, you know, you're going to see fairly often, maybe on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, having that energy and having that something you worked on and having put that energy in, kind of radiate energy back out into your space. So I think it is a very profound creative process.
Clover, one last question here, because watering is kind of a big deal, especially when you're talking about plants in the home. What's your tip in regards to handling the water situation?
The water situation. Well, this is a tip from someone who is a little better with plants than I am. If your plants are, you know, okay with it, because it's definitely, it's funny. The florist I talked to, she described just it all as a conversation, you know, like you find plants and the things that you're interested and want to arrange and work with, you know, what speaks to you. But you also kind of pay attention to how these plants speak to each other, whether that's, you know, talking to that florist or there to help you figure out which plants, you know, play, like grow nicely together so you can take care of them at the same time without, you know, one maybe drowning and one getting thirsty, you know. But if, you know, your plants will allow, she was always really great about, you know, you could put like ice cubes in them or like smaller amounts of like way of watering, so it's like it'll slowly melt, it'll be okay, you know, you're not going to drown them if you put a couple ice cubes in your flower pots and whatnot. So that was actually a really nice tip that she taught me, and it's saved my succulent garden quite a few times this winter.
Ice cubes. Now we're talking. I love that. Maybe the next spider plants I get won't die. Clover, thank you for this. Always a pleasure chatting with you. Enjoy the season of blooming.
Yes, you too. And hopefully everyone, you know, maybe gives a try out, enjoys the season, maybe tries out a little bit of gardening, a little bit of flower arrangement, and just enjoy the fact that winter is kind of sort of almost over.
It's kind of sort of almost over. I like that. It's a beautiful way of phrasing that. Clover, have a great day.
You too. Bye, everyone.
That is Clover Thursday, community artist and columnist on Now with Dave Brown. Coming up after the break, Shiny Saravanamuthu, community reporter, will tell you about a couple Easter-themed events that are taking place in Montreal. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. I don't know why I'm thanking you, probably just thanking you for being a part of the show. As the pages of the calendar continue to turn, Easter is on the horizon. It's not this weekend, it's next weekend. WrestleMania this weekend, Easter the following weekend. You got to mark these things on your calendar. And that means all kinds of events are taking place for friends, families, and kids to enjoy. Community reporter Shiny Saravanamuthu has a few events to highlight in the Montreal area. Hey, good morning, Shiny.
Morning, how are you?
Shiny, I'm good. When I was a kid, I always loved me an Easter egg hunt, but it was always small potatoes. It was small scale. You've got the inside scoop on the 25K Easter egg hunt taking place in Montreal. Why is this one worth checking out?
Because I low-key wish I had this growing up, because this is like the real deal. So since it's the first time that they're doing it since COVID, they're going super extra. So this is taking place on April 1st, starts at 9 a.m. sharp and goes up until 3 p.m. And it's free for kids under the age of 12. And for adults, it comes up to about $13 after the service fee and taxes and all that fun stuff. So they are hiding a total of 25,000 treats, candy, eggs, and prizes throughout the area for the kids to find. In order for it to be fair, they are staggering the start time based on age groups. So the younger kids have a fair chance of finding the eggs, and then the older kids are like the last group to go. I think this is actually pretty awesome, just because I know as parents, like, they do the best they can, and usually in the backyard. This is kind of fun. Like, you can go with a group of friends, you can bring your friends and their kids, and, like, you know, just have a little nice event for them to have. And it's kind of nice that it's not on Easter weekend itself.
Mm-hmm.
Weekend before, so, like, you know, you can do your family stuff on Easter weekend, and this is something fun for the kids, and it's a great way to get them going. They also have different events happening alongside the Easter egg hunt. They have like an Easter basket painting station. They have each kid gets to take a selfie with Easter Bunny or his family member. So they encourage you to bring a camera to take a selfie with Easter Bunny. And this year they actually have like to promote exercising and kids being active, they actually have like a kid-friendly marathon happening as well.
Oh my gosh. They're running the full gambit here on April 1st.
Yeah, so I think it's a great way. It's very inexpensive. Like, the kids don't have to pay anything, and they get a free, like, they get to take home whatever they find. And they actually have a golden egg hidden for each age group. So whoever gets that golden egg gets a special prize at the end of the day.
Well, parents, I know, will be grateful to have something for the kids to do as well, especially if the weather is nice on Saturday in Montreal. So 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern time, all over the downtown core. There's a big, long Eventbrite page for this one, and I'm not going to read the whole address because we'd be here the rest of the hour. But you know where that link is going to go, ami.ca/now. Much easier to remember for the details on the 25K Easter egg hunt. Shiny, that's not the only Easter-related event going down, because there's also an Easter brunch and piggy bank hunt that's going on. So keeping with the theme, what's the significance of this event? Who's hosting it and why?
So this is kind of neat as also another way to get out and have an event on Easter weekend if you're not doing anything. This is on the Saturday of April 8th. Brunch starts at 9, goes up until 12, and then the remaining the hunt starts at 11:30 and goes on till about 1:30 p.m. And the good thing about this, it's a fundraiser. So it's actually going to be raising money for the Montreal Children's Theatre. So it's a great way to give back, and it's not expensive at all either. So the hunt itself is free, but if you want to be there for the brunch, it's $15 for adults, $10 for kids, and you can buy additional raffle tickets to win additional prizes. And the piggy bank is basically, they're going to be hidden, and there'll be like a voucher inside the piggy bank of what prize you can win. So this is kind of cool. Like, you can have fun, eat some good food, go for a little hunt, and give back at the same time. So I think it's a really neat event, and it's on the Saturday. So most people don't have events on the Saturday. So it's a great way to get out there and do something with the kids. Or you can just go as an adult.
Or you can, yeah, you can just go as a kid at heart. Shiny, yeah. I may be putting you on the spot with this one.
Yeah.
But why piggy banks?
Me? I'm not sure, to be honest. I was trying to figure out why they were going to the piggy bank. I think maybe it's like a treasure hunt. Maybe they want to generalize into Easter and put it all under one. I was trying to figure out what the significance was for the piggy banks, but if I ever find out, I will love to share, because I'm really confused. Mostly you do like Easter eggs, you know, and I was kind of confused, but they've been doing piggy banks, so maybe it's a way to like, maybe since the fundraiser is piggy bank to raise money, maybe that's the
reason. Maybe there was a sale on piggy banks at the Dollarama, so they were like, ah, we're going to use piggy banks instead of Easter eggs this time. It's all the Easter eggs got bought by the 25K Easter egg hunt, so we had to shift gears. Shiny, if I had to do a vibe check right now for the city of Montreal, what's the energy like in the city now that sort of all of these cultural events are coming back?
I think the city is slowly like waking up in the sense that it's nicer now, it's brighter later, so people are staying downtown a little later after work, you know, people are more out and about. It's just, even in the mornings, you hear the birds chirping, so it's like everyone's a bit more like happier, you know, you have a little pep in your step. So I think the city's getting happier and like more active, so it's nice to see. And I think as the weather gets, not even now, like this week has been a little warm, so outside, like as you're walking, you see more people outside going for walks, you're seeing your neighbors a bit more. So I think you'll be seeing more humans. I know you're not a huge human person, but you'll be seeing more humans.
I am not a huge human person, and I live in the most densely populated city in the country. So that shows you where my brain's at, is a perpetual study in contrasts. Shiny, I'll say this. I will perpetually extol the virtues of Vancouver in March. To me, if you're going to spend March in any city in Canada, it is Vancouver. If you're going to spend April in any city in the country, it's Montreal, especially right around, say, call it April 10th, April 15th, when you really start to feel the spring. I don't think there's any city that can compete with the vibe on St. Catherine Street or Sherbrooke Street, walking through downtown on April the 15th at 5:30 p.m. on a Thursday or Friday. Oh, Shiny. No city can replicate what Montreal does around that time of year.
Yeah, it's the second sets get real fun because it's warmer, and so it's nicer. And like Old Port around that weekend gets really busy, because as soon as it's super nice to go to Old Port, everyone runs there. So yeah, Montreal's super nice when it gets to be really nice outside. Mm. So I'm looking forward to that.
So just a couple more reminders here in regards to the Easter brunch and piggy bank hunt. That's April 8th, Saturday in Montreal. Once again, more information on that event will be shared on the blog after the show, ami.ca/now. Shiny, thank you so much for this. Always a pleasure chatting with you. We'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Perfect. Sounds great.
That is Shiny Saravanamuthu, community reporter in Montreal, Quebec. Coming up after the break, I've got the regional news update, and then Brock Richardson stops by for a sports chat. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV.
Join me every couple weeks for the Outdoors with Lawrence Gunther podcast, where we learn about outdoor tech and tips. Plus, we look at news affecting the environment. AMI's Outdoors with Lawrence Gunther is available from your favorite podcast provider.